You are listening to Invest in the Future by Future Africa. Future Africa is a platform connecting mission-driven innovators and investors looking to turn Africa's most difficult challenges into global business opportunities. Please note that the content of this podcast is not to be regarded as investment advice.
But Sebastian, it's very, very good to have you today. Thanks so much for making the time to join us here. As a side, maybe what I would say is that incidentally, before I knew that you're coming to speak with us, I read your book, More Money Than God, at the beginning of the year. And as I was reading that, I saw this tweet from Paul Graham of Y Combinator saying the best book you can read about venture capital is The Power Law, right? And then Patrick from Stripe also made this comment about the book, and I just picked that up right there and then. So I think I'm in the right company for someone that I've read twice this year. And so thanks so much for making the time to speak with us. I don't know where you are joining us from. Are you in London?
Yes, I'm in London.
Oh, perfect, perfect. So my name is Peter Kisada, like my colleague said, and I'm a principal here at Future Africa. So what that means is I really oversee our research and investments. But before we can go into the conversation, what I prefer is, just give us a brief introduction about yourself. As an author, as an individual, and then we can start from there.
Sure. Well, it's great to be here, Peter, and Future Africa, thank you for having me. I'm particularly happy because, in fact, the early part of my career, I was a journalist when I left university. I joined The Economist magazine, and I was the Africa correspondent. And wow. I lived in Zimbabwe for maybe a bit over a year at one point, and otherwise I was living in London and traveling to the continent. And in fact, I was covering South Africa when Nelson Mandela came out of jail. So I was there watching Mandela walk out, and I thought it was the most exciting moment in my life, and my career would be downhill after that, since I was 25 at the time, so I was a bit depressed that my career had already peaked. So anyway, that's how I began with writing. And as time went by, I wrote five books. The first one was about South Africa, actually. It was called After Apartheid. And then I wrote four more books. Some of them are about different kinds of finance. So development finance, I wrote a book about the World Bank. And then I wrote one about hedge funds, one about the Federal Reserve and central banking, and then one about venture capital. So that's my background.
So did you write all these books after when you thought that the career had peaked, or were some of these before?
No, it was all after my career peaked, then I fell back on writing books. But watching Mandela come out of jail was certainly a high point.
Yeah, okay, interesting. I think for me, when you say that you're an author, it means that there's so many things you can write about, right? Now, your latest book is about venture capital. Why that particular topic and why now?
Yeah, so one of the reasons is that, venture capital is just quite intellectually mysterious. Most kinds of investing, you have some quantitative metrics. You can think about the price earnings ratio of a share, or you can think about the book to price value of the share. With early stage venture investments, of course, you don't have any financial guidelines. You just have a couple of founders who come into your office with a dream, and they tell you a story about the future. And you have to decide if you're going to make an investment. And it's much more subjective, much more story driven, much less quantitative. And so all investment is risky. It's about a tough bet on an uncertain future. And the question is, venture capital is so much more uncertain that how do you even begin to do that? I was interested in trying to figure that out and to understand it through stories about particular early investments. So I went to Silicon Valley and talked to both the founders and the VCs about how they connected, in the very beginning, the seed stage, the Series A stage. And then the other thing is that, venture capital is spreading around the world. It's more and more important. And so why now? Well, now is the moment when it's spreading geographically, it's spreading into new industries, and it's spreading along the life cycle of the company because company is going public at a later stage, a higher valuation. So, you know, venture capital is just, I think, becoming the third great pillar of capitalism. After the company, you know, and after the market mechanism, you've got the third pillar, which is VC enabled networks of startups. I think it's super interesting and also super timely.
I see. When you say it's timely, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that it's, as I say, it's sort of spreading around the world. You know, Future Africa, how many years have you been in business, Peter?
You would say professionally, it's coming to 3 years.
3 years, there you are. So it's quite new. And so yes, when I began my book, it didn't even exist. I've been researching this for 5 years. So stuff has been happening. It's exciting. It's spreading. Coming to Africa, coming to Latin America, growing in Europe, growing in India. You know, this is a big deal. If you look through the pandemic, the size of the venture capital dollars in the US, I mean, I think it tripled or something. It was just an enormous growth in those 2 years. So something that was already important became much, much more important.
I think what I want to understand from your perspective is, as you've been researching this, when you look at the impact that venture capital has had, right, in other geographies like the West and China, and now other emerging markets, where does Africa fit in your lens?
I mean, I think Africa is the exciting, you know, new growth area. It's coming from a low base, and so I think a good idea to keep in your head when you're thinking about anything to do with venture capital and startups is the curve is normally exponential, meaning that it's sort of flat at the beginning. And, you know, the number of startups in, say, West Africa might be growing from, let's just pick some rough numbers, I don't know. Let's say there are 500 startups in, you know, 1 year, and then a couple of years later, there's 1,000. So it's doubling. But it's still, you know, just beginning. But when it goes from 1,000 to 2,000, that's a bigger jump. And when it goes from 20,000 to 40,000. So as the exponential curve progresses, you know, at the beginning, it's quite flat. And then it starts to go up, if you can see my finger like this. And we're not there yet in Africa, but we're going to be there. So I think Africa is a super exciting place, and it might take, you know, another 10 years to really get onto that vertical part of the exponential curve, but it will happen.
Yeah. I see. My colleague is leaving a comment in the chat saying we will. So that's Chiba. I work with him at Future Africa.
Okay.
I'm excited about this, but part of it is because I think you're one person that has had a view of all the other, you know, elements of capital, you know, private equity, the hedge funds, now venture capital. How do you look at it? Is it that venture capital can, because in Africa, some of these are not existent, right? Like hedge funds, right? We have something around private equity, but how do you see venture capital playing out in other markets other than the West? Is it something that's going to make up for all the non-existence of other forms of capital, or channel its own, you know, its own path?
I think it can do its own path. The one thing is you do need a way of having an exit. And so either, you know, a startup is going to go public eventually. So there needs to be a stock market where you can go public. Or it might be bought, but then you need an acquirer. So long as you think there's an exit strategy in the end, it could be 10 years away, but still. Then I think you can make this work. The other ingredients from a sort of policy perspective, which are important, are, you know, there needs to be a decent ability to give employee stock options to early employees. And I don't know how it is in Africa, but some countries, the laws don't really allow for employee stock options. The tax provisions are too onerous or whatever. And So, for example, in the early stages of doing venture capital in China, it was difficult. And so they set up a system with like parent companies offshore in Cayman Islands, which then issued these equity options because the Chinese law didn't make it possible. I don't know how it is in Africa.
Yeah. Actually, I think that's a very interesting point. Could we talk a little bit further about employee stock options? And I'm saying this because I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but internally we are going through the same process and we always emphasize that all our portfolio companies do the same. Could you just talk about why is that very important for VCs to understand and also startups and regulators and lawmakers?
Well, you know, one of the best ways of making everybody be on the same team is that everybody in the process should have some equity. So the startup investor, the venture capitalist, is investing money in exchange for equity. Then the founders of the company own some equity in the company. Then the early employees should also own equity in the company because you've got to make people really excited about succeeding. And so participation in the upside in the form of either equity or equity options is really, really important to get alignment between all the different stakeholders.
Yeah. And how much is it a function of culture? Because you talked about the fact that in your book, you talk about geographical differences, right? And culture differences. There is the Bay Area where, you know, IP could just move around freely. And then you have another culture elsewhere, you know, looking at in China, totally different culture. Right, like how much of the cultural difference does this have to play in order for people to get buy-in in terms of the ESOPs?
Yeah.
I don't know if the question is clear.
Yeah, in terms of the employee stock options, the ESOPs, yeah.
Exactly.
I think that, the cultural question I come up against a lot, particularly when I speak in Europe to European audiences, is they say, look, yeah, you know, we're a rich economy. We have lots of technically trained people who understand software and all that. But what we don't have is the culture that Silicon Valley has. We don't have a risk-taking culture.
Yeah.
And I always argue that that's a mistake to worry about that because the culture will change. You know, culture is not fixed and static. I'll give you an example. I was speaking to a venture capitalist in India. And he described to me how, you know, 10 years ago, people were suspicious about startups. And now they are very much in favor of startups.
Yes.
And so you can measure this in a funny way. You know, fathers of daughters, you know, they used to not want their daughter to marry a entrepreneur because they thought entrepreneur is risky. And now they are quite happy for their daughter to marry an entrepreneur. Because they think entrepreneur is cool, and if it works, it could be a huge upside. And even if it doesn't work, you can have a second chance and start another company. And so in just one decade in India, the culture has really changed on the question of attitudes towards entrepreneurship and small company startups and risk and all that stuff. And I think venture capital, by the way, plays a very important role in creating that change of culture. You know, right back in the early days of Silicon Valley, there was no entrepreneurship culture, but the venture capitalists came along and they said to people who were engineers or whatever, hey, you can start your own company. And the engineer would say, ooh, I don't have any money for that. And the venture capitalists say, well, we'll get you money. And then the engineer would say, yeah, but I don't know how to set up a company. How do you even do that? I don't know what the laws are. And the venture capitalists would say, no problem. We know the lawyers and we'll set you up with a company.
Yes.
And then the venture capitalist would say, I mean, the entrepreneur would say, yeah, but how do you hire people? I mean, it's a startup, it's risky. We don't know how you would hire the first five engineers. And the venture capitalist would say, I've got a network. I know people you can hire. We can interview these people together and persuade them to come and join the startup. And if they don't want to join the startup because it's risky, we'll say, listen, we're going to give you stock options And,
yes.
And if the company doesn't work, then you can join another startup because the venture capitalists will know other startups that you can join if the first one doesn't work.
Yes.
So, I think the cultural attitudes matter, but they can be changed. And that's part of what the venture capitalists do as they build the ecosystem.
I actually particularly enjoyed the part around Don Valentine handling most of the renegades of Silicon Valley, like Steve Jobs and the Atari team, and him going as far as literally washing them up to be presentable to other funders on the East Coast and the West Coast. What I'm getting to is that we've seen venture capital evolve and the role of venture capitalists evolve. Right now, in your book, you talk about S16Z, which is like a boutique, not a boutique firm, but like the creative arts agency of venture capital. You find everything in there. And then you also have founders fund. Then you also have internationalized funds like Square Capital that have, you know, branches everywhere in the world. So right now, from your perspective, what's the role of an investor? Are they local? Are they international? If you're local, what should you offer? If you're international, what should you offer to the founders?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the founder's point of view, there are some startups that see themselves as serving the local market. And then, you know, maybe a local VC is the best.
Yes.
And then there are some founders who say, hey, I'm going to build, you know, a service as a software company or whatever it is, and I'm going to sell this product to people all over the world. And this is not just for Africa. This is going to be American customers, European customers. And then you might want an investor who's got connections in Europe or America who can introduce you to customers there.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's not either or. You might have a Series A investment from a local African venture capital firm. And then if you do well after Series A, you're doing Series B, Series C. By this point, you're having ambition to ship your product to people in Europe. And so you want a European VC, and then maybe Series D, you want to go to America. So you have an American VC. I think you can bring in different kinds of VC at different points in your journey.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. And the other point that I think I'm also looking at is we are seeing investors, because typically before it was that a typical investor comes from the West and then they venture East. So that's India, that's Southeast Asia, then China. But now we're seeing actually venture capitalists in other markets like, you know, India trying to look west for opportunities. So how do you see this playing out eventually? Is it going to be, you know, I can invest anywhere in the world, or whoever has the most money takes everything? Or like, how do you see this?
You know, I think it's not a question of whoever has the most money takes everything. I don't think that's how it works. And the reason is that, you know, startup investing is a very hands-on business. You go on the board of the startup, you really try to partner with a startup founder, and you really try to add value and advice and be there, right? And so the money is only one part of what you're delivering. You're also delivering this partnership, human capital, as well as financial capital. And so I think good VCs are really big on this partnering side of it. And so in the end, the winners in venture capital are the ones who offer that, human partnership and skills and connectivity. So I think, you know, if you're an African startup, you want to take money from the partnership that's going to offer you that, you know, value add in terms of advice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at different points in your journey, you're going to take, you know, either the local African partner, because the African VC can physically show up to your meetings, can know the local market, can introduce you to people within your own country or your own region.
Yeah.
And then maybe later on, you want to take money from a European VC because you want to have introductions in Europe. But it's really not just about, you know, who has the most money is not really the answer. It's like, who has the most knowledge?
Yes.
It's the knowledge that matters,
I talked about the market becoming internationalized in that money is flowing in from inner parts of the world. So I was talking about the fact that the market is becoming internationalized. So what you're seeing is the likes of Square Capital, A16Z, these traditional funds like Founders Fund also are making their first foray into Africa. And when that happens, what you're seeing is that rounds are becoming competitive. So investors are fighting to get into the best companies. Now, I'm saying this take us to part of your book, which is about Uber, right? Bill Gulley and everyone that was involved in the company around governance. So we are having these challenges of founders want things to move fast. Investors want fast look at the deal and assess that. So how do you bring the two together? How do you ensure that things are moving very fast, but at the same time, governance is not being thrown out for the sake of being founder friendly?
Yeah. I think fast is good, but what's not so good is not going on the board. And, you know, there are certain investors that get into deals by saying, hey, Mr. Entrepreneur, you know, you're going to be in charge of your own company and we're not going to bother you. And some entrepreneurs might like that idea because they get to control the company. But frankly, it's not a good model because even the best entrepreneurs or even the best human beings, they need other talented people around them to make them the best that they can be. Like, I'm quite good at writing books. I've written 5 books. I consider myself a good writer, but I still want the best editor I can get. And I want the best, you know, readers, like friends of mine who will read my manuscript before I publish it and tell me, hey, Sebastian, you know, I like chapter 1, but chapter 2 is really not very good. You could really make that better. You know, why don't you think about the following? You want, you know, however good you are, you want partners who are going to make you better. And and so I think when a founder's raising money, it's fair to say, look, I want to raise the money quite quickly. I don't want to have to spend months and months like not running my business because I'm talking to investors. That's unproductive. But you do want, you know, you want an investor who can make a decision efficiently without taking too much time, but then who also efficiently engages after the investment and gives you, you know, it doesn't bother you all the time, but is always there for you if you want advice.
Yeah, I see.
And I think, you know, I would be concerned, like if I was an African founder and, you know, an American VC like Sequoia or A16Z came to me and said, you know, I'd like to invest, I would say, well, all right, but, you know, you're a long way away. How are we going to have a relationship? How are you going to partner with me? How are you going to give me quality advice? Will you have time?
Yes. Okay, I see. Thank you so much. So I have one last question before I can bring in our community of founders, advisors, and investors. And the question is, why the Power Law? Why did you name the book The Power Law?
Yeah. Well, because of the skewed distribution of venture capital returns. In other words, when a venture capital investor has, let's say, 10 investments, a normal pattern might be that, you know, something like 7 or 8 basically fail. That's just the hard reality of startups. It's really difficult to build a startup that does well. And so it's just normal that 7 or 8 investments will fail out of 10. But what you hope is that like 1 or 2 are going to do more than 10x the invested capital in Series A. So if you've got one investment, if you're the investor and you have one investment, it does 10x, it means that, you know, that makes back the entire fund if 1 out of 10 is 10x mathematically. So you make back the whole fund. And then if you've got 2 that do more than 10x, now you're doubling your fund, right? So that's the vision of the investor. And it's a power law return distribution. It's not a normal distribution. In a normal distribution, a normal is a statistical phrase that is implying a bell curve where, you know, there's an average return, which is say 15% or something, and most of the investments earn about 15%. And that's, you know, for a hedge fund, that's what you might see. Like the average investment is making 15%, and two thirds of the investments are between 10 and 20.
If I was an outsider listening to you, that sounds like gambling, right? But in your book, you talk about some of the best performing fund managers in venture capital. So what are the key determinants of a good, what makes a good fund manager, a good VC?
Yeah, you're right. It does sound like gambling. If you say, here's a venture capitalist and the investments go like this, zero, 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 15x, zero, zero. I mean, that sounds like there was one complete lucky break, right? But it's not just luck. It is about intelligently understanding the startup story. The startup founder comes to you and says, here's what I'm trying to do. And you have an intelligent assessment of whether that's even possible, whether if it worked, it would be a big outcome, big enough to justify the risk. And then after you invest, you also have an intelligent way of partnering with the founder so that you can add value as an investor and give good advice and make good introductions and connect that founder to really value-added early employees who could be brought on board, value-added customers who could be introduced to the startup. So I think there are definite ways that venture capitalists can be good or bad, even though there's a power law distribution of returns that looks lucky.
Okay, good. So like I said, we have a community of investors, founders, and advisors that are listening in right now. Before you came on the webinar, we had asked them to send through some questions. So I'll read from some of those questions, but also those that are listening in, please leave your questions in the Q&A section, which I'll be able to pick up. And then if you can raise your hand, do that. I'll also be able to get a few people to come and speak. Please keep in mind that we only have 30 minutes, so we are going to try as much as possible to pack everything in there. If you're not picked, we hope that we can be able to still, you know, as Sebastian is explaining, maybe touch your point here and there. So the first question that is here is from Stefan Eboko. And Stefan asks, Sebastian, what's your take on Web3 and its potential in Africa?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm thinking about writing my next book about Web3 and crypto and DeFi and all that stuff. So I'm starting to learn about it. My feeling is that, you know, it is a very, like, venture capital is a risky space. So DeFi and crypto and Web3 is even more risky because it's so new and so speculative and so kind of like people are putting out great visions, but figuring out which one's going to work is really difficult. So if you take just like the tokens, the crypto tokens, there are so many of them and they all have different arguments for why they are valuable or why they should be valuable. And every few months, a whole bunch of other tokens get invented. And so it's super difficult to know which ones are really going to be around in 10 years' time.
Yes.
It feels as though Bitcoin is, you know, it's the oldest. It's been there 13 years. It feels like it's not going to go away. The rest, but on the other hand, Bitcoin has disadvantages, right? It's got, you can't do smart contracts in the blockchain for Bitcoin. So if there are going to be smart contracts, they're going to be in what's called layer two, coming on top of the Bitcoin, but not directly in the Bitcoin blockchain. And so that, you know, different people have a different opinion about whether that's a big problem. There's also the question of, you know, it's a proof of work token. And so that's expensive, you know, the computing resources that go into proof of work, solving all these algorithms and building the blockchain is a cost. And then also you've got the question, which may be quite far away, but ultimately, how do you continue to make the blockchain work when you've mined the 21 million Bitcoins that the algorithm permits. I'm not sure what happens after that. So I think it's, you know, to figure out what's hype and what's real is a challenge in Web3. But I also think that large amounts of talent are going into it. Something is going to stick. It's just that we don't really know yet what's going to stick.
Okay, thank you. There is this other question that I think I really, really like. And the person just says, how are startups affected by the power law?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way they're affected is not a nice way, but they're affected in that it's really, really risky to do a startup. It's like, it's really hard. And, you know, the way that a venture capitalist deals with that difficulty is to figure, okay, many of these startups will fail, but at least the ones that work are going to make a lot of money and pay me back. But if you're the founder, you're not diversified in that way. You know, you may work on it really hard for 5 years and then it just fails. And not because it's your fault, but just because, you know, you're building a product and then the whole tech platform that you're working on moves in a different direction. So let's say you're building your platform and it depends on reaching customers by Facebook ads. And then Facebook changes the algorithm because of something to do with what the Apple store is, you know, the iOS system is demanding. And all of a sudden you can't reach your customers through targeted Facebook ads because Apple is demanding privacy, right? So stuff that you, there's no way you can predict can impact your business model. And it's not your fault. But it may mean your business fails. So I think that's just the reality. It's just a really hard road to go. So you have to be super committed and really all in. And you have to really want to do it. And I think there's no getting around the fact that it's a hard path for founders, and they have to be special kind of people to do it.
Thank you. The next question is about the ESG. And the person is asking, are ESG investments included in venture capital sector in Africa? And how do you evaluate the growth path of sustainable finance in the coming years in Africa? I don't know if that's understood.
Yeah, look, I think definitely that ESG, and particularly the environmental bit, is a real, you know, permanent change in the world, right? I mean, the fact is global warming is happening and it's really going to, you know, mess up the planet. And we're going to be desperate to figure out ways to mitigate that. And so anybody who can do something which helps to mitigate carbon emissions, whether it's through offsets because you're protecting mangrove swamps, off the coast of, you know, which is, I think, is a business in West Africa. I've heard people doing that. Or whether it's because you're going to do solar power. I mean, I think all these things are super important for the planet. And increasingly, people are going to find ways of building businesses around that. And some of this will be venture-backed businesses. And I do think that there's big opportunity there.
Okay. So I have two of my colleagues on the call. We have E Inyolua and Adenike. So I don't know if E and Adenike, you're there. I would love you to come in and ask, because E, I've seen some of your questions in the chat. I don't know if you want to ask those live.
Sure, I think that I'll do. Hi, everyone. Sebastian, it's been a pleasure to listen to you and learn from your great wealth of experience. Thank you so much for taking the time to share. I think my question is, you shared a lot of interesting events and stories in your book, you know, about Silicon Valley and the key players. What would you say is your favorite story from all the stories that you like best that you've come across in Silicon Valley, and just paint the picture of the power law and, you know, the power of VC to drive innovation?
Sure. Gosh, it's difficult to choose one, but let me give you the example of Uber. The Uber story is interesting because right at the beginning, before Uber existed, a venture capitalist called Bill Gurley at Benchmark imagined Uber was going to exist, right? So what happened is that Bill Gurley was interested in network businesses where you have a marketplace and there are buyers and sellers, but if you create a digital marketplace that brings the buyers and the sellers together in a more efficient way, the bigger that network grows, the more value it creates, right? And so this was done first of all by eBay. It was the first sort of digital marketplace that really managed to make this work. And the more people who wanted to sell things on eBay, the more buyers loved eBay because there's more stuff you could buy. So more buyers came and then more sellers came because there were more people you could sell to. And the value of this network grew as the square of the number of people on it. So when there were only two people on it, it was worth four. And when there were 200 people on it, it was worth 40,000, as it were. So it just grows and grows exponentially. And Benchmark did really well by investing in eBay. And then it invested in a thing called OpenTable, which brought restaurants together with people who wanted to go to restaurants. And they put an app in the middle that meant you could search for the particular restaurant you wanted. And that did really well. And then Bill Gurley, who did OpenTable, who was the investor in OpenTable, was thinking to himself, what other business could we do where you put information in the middle, you have a digital form of marketplace, and then the buyers and the sellers will love it and more will come. And he had this idea that, you know, transport would work, that there are people who want to get cars, there are people who want to drive cars and provide the service of driving the car. And if you can make them easier to find each other, that's a business. And he had this idea before Uber existed. And he went, first of all, to see a company called Taxi Magic that was thinking of doing this, but he thought they were doing it in the wrong way. So he didn't invest. And then a bit later, Uber was founded, but the CEO was a very young guy. And Bill Gurley didn't think that this young guy was going to make it work. And then finally, Uber like rebooted and had a different CEO, Travis Kalanick, who was more experienced. And then finally, Bill Gurley said, yes, you know, this is the right formula. This matches my idea and I'm going to invest. So Bill Gurley really had the prepared mind. He had the idea before he saw the company. And then once he saw the company, he could invest really quickly because he already knew the idea. And then he partnered with Travis Kalanick and he kind of guided him along. And Travis Kalanick was really aggressive and really strong entrepreneur. And he made this thing work. He grew it. But then once Uber started to get big, you get into phase two of the story where Bill Gurley lost influence in Uber because these other later investors were investing. And as I was saying earlier, they didn't bother to, you know, go on the board or exert any governance oversight. And that's when Uber started to go wrong. It started to get in trouble with the law. You know, it was cutting corners. It was being unethical. And Bill Gurley understood this, but he couldn't stop them because he, you know, he was a Series A investor. And by now he had been diluted and he didn't have any influence anymore. And so that's when Uber went wrong. So I think Uber is a good story because it shows you both how a smart venture capitalist can add value at the beginning, but then when he loses influence, the company can go wrong.
Thank you so much. I don't know, Adenike, you're on mute?
Yes, I was saying that's so interesting because, you know, from that story, it seems like the magic exists. There's a sweet spot where, you know, the investor already has a clear picture of what needs to be built. And they meet an entrepreneur who's thinking on the same wavelength and both of them meet. And, you know, he brings the funding, the entrepreneur brings the strength and the power in it day to day, and you build a $1 billion business like Uber. But, you know, obviously there's also limitations to that, which you've explained. If you're an early investor, you might lose influence. So I think my next question off the back of that would be, what would you say are the most important qualities that the most successful VCs have? You know, the VCs who have been able to drive these admirable returns on a consistent basis and haven't just done it once or twice, but they've constantly invested in companies that have changed the world, you know, for lack of a better way to put it. Beyond the fact that they're able to imagine the world differently and think of these revolutionary business ideas, what qualities do you think set them apart to take advantage of the power law?
Danica, it's a great question. I think there are two things. One is an ability to connect with people. To be a venture capitalist, it's a people business. You're partnering with an entrepreneur who is a human being, and you need to be able to like understand that entrepreneur and be an effective and kind of sensitive partner. And by sensitive, I'm talking partly that, you know, as I said earlier, doing a startup is really, really difficult, and most startups fail. So there's going to be ups and downs, and you're going to go through highs when something goes right, and you're going to go through lows. And a good venture capitalist, for example, one of the things that the venture capitalist will do is will be like, when the entrepreneur is excited and up, the VC will say, okay, but there's going to be a challenge tomorrow, and here's a tough question for you to think about to get ready for the tough challenge. So when the entrepreneur is on a high, the VC is being sober and kind of like bringing them down a bit. But when something goes wrong and the entrepreneur is on a low, then the VC is up to try to, you know, lift up your spirits and say, listen, this happens with startups. You've just taken a blow, but you can pivot. And okay, Facebook isn't going to be useful for targeting your ads, but there are other ways we can do ads, and we're going to still find your customers. So I think you can modulate the emotional ups and downs as a venture capitalist, but you need to have enormous emotional intelligence to do that. So that's the first thing. Second thing is actually just normal intelligence. It's like normal, a good sense of, okay, this is a kind of business that you're building and you've got this plan, but you could make the plan even better if you ask yourself the question, maybe you could produce a different version of the product and reach this additional market. So for example, right at the early point of my story, I write about Atari, the first video game maker. And it was making these products that, you know, kind of games that it would put in bars. And so it would be, you know, the customer would be the bar or the restaurant. And the venture capitalists had the idea, hey, we could also make this as a product for individual families to buy to have at their home. So you could make the home product of your thing. And if you make the game for the restaurants, you're only going to sell like, you know, 50 in a city. But if you make it for the home market, you could sell 50,000, right? So it's bringing new ideas, like, and connecting you to the right people and being persuasive about connecting you to other people.
Thank you so much. So I'll let E or Peter speak, and I think we have some interesting questions from the audience. But those were very, very insightful answers. Thank you so much.
E, are you still there?
I'm right here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can hear you.
Awesome. Thank you, Sebastian, for doing this, and super delighted to have our principals on the podium with you. I had two questions, related questions, that I had wanted to ask, and I actually put them in the chat because I hope somebody else would ask them. I think one of the points you make repeatedly in your book, I'm halfway through it, is that, you know, the power law distribution tends to work when you make contrarian bets, sort of like the kind of the ones that Vinod made. And I'm wondering, you know, what industries and what geographies do you see as today's contrarian bet, and why are more people in venture capital investing there? So, I mean, I tend to think about Africa, for example, as a very contrarian bet. So why isn't there more venture capital? I mean, last year we did do a lot of venture capital, but only 5% of venture capital is coming here. So why is it more venture capital coming here, if especially by the folks who sort of have had a history of creating this sort of outcomes? And also, you know, the other question I had Was that there are there spaces that tend to greater power law outcomes more so than others? You know, is there a power law of power law industries? and what are they? And how can one break into those? Those are my two questions.
Thank you. Those are great questions, E, and it's an honor to speak with you because I'm aware of your enormous reputation in African venture and entrepreneurship. So on your questions, yes, power law implication includes the idea that, you know, you're either going to fail as a startup or you're going to probably be really big. And to be really big, you've got to be pretty different. You've got to be doing something that other people are not doing. Because if you do something where there are lots of competitors, the competition is going to squeeze your margin and it's going to be tough to make a big profit. So differentiation is important. And that often means contrarian because, you know, it has to be a kind of slightly out of the box idea. Otherwise, other people will do it. And so, you know, a good example would be Airbnb, right? The whole concept of Airbnb that, you know, people who own houses or apartments will happily have total strangers to sleep on their couch or in their spare room. It's like before Airbnb, nobody thought anyone would do that. It's like crazy idea. You know, some stranger comes to my house. Why would I, wasn't that risky? And Airbnb made it okay. And it was a really contrarian idea. Other times the idea is less contrarian, but you're seeing a bit around the corner. So you're seeing that, okay, we've done eBay. Therefore there should be something like Uber. And you have that idea before anybody else has it. So it's less contrarian, but it is around the corner. It's like over the horizon. Other people haven't seen it yet. So I think stretching when you're setting up a startup is required by the power law because you've got to be in that. You've got to be an exceptional startup to really be successful. So yes, so why wouldn't people come to Africa more? And I think the answer is that the stretching is difficult. And in particular, stretching into a new geography is scary for people. And you know, one of the features about the whole venture capital space is that it's human capital intensive. As I was saying earlier, this is not just about writing checks. This is not something where you say, oh, you know, I'm Sequoia from Silicon Valley. I've got, you know, billions of dollars to invest, so I can just win globally. No. You've got to put people on the ground who understand the local conditions and who work to actually go meet everybody. And that requires finding the person who can do that. It's not easy. And so Sequoia only established an office in Europe like a couple of years ago. And it's still pretty new. So it just took them a long time to get to Europe. And in the same way, it's going to take them a long time to set up an office in Africa. I believe one day they're going to do it, but it'll probably be, you know, 10 more years before they do it. Because just it's a human capital intensive business. You need to know people in Africa. And most people don't have that, which means it's good for you, E, because you do. And so you know, you're the market leader here. And those other guys from Silicon Valley are not going to catch up for a while. And they're going to need to partner with you. You know, you're going to be doing the early stage stuff. And they're going to say, please, E, please introduce me to your company so I can do Series B or Series C or Series D. So I think it's good news for you and good news for sort of people who are already in Africa, who understand Africa. And if you can just make sure that the regulatory environment is there so that you can do exits, there is a way of listing companies, that you can do employee stock options, that they're not blocked by local tax laws. If you can get a few of the basics in terms of regulatory structure right, and then you sell your story to Western LPs in Europe or America, who should be privileged and proud to be able to invest with you because you're in such a good position and you're so embedded in the African ecosystem, then this is going to work. I mean, when I get asked this question by American interviewers, they say to me, "Okay, so imagine you're the Harvard Endowment, and you want to back another general partner, a new venture capital partnership, you know, what are you looking for? And I say embeddedness. You've got to back a GP who is seriously embedded in the space they want to bet on. And so embeddedness can mean that you know everything there is to know about a certain type of SaaS software, and you live in Los Altos, California, in the middle of Silicon Valley. But a different kind of embeddedness is you live in Nigeria and you really, really know the Nigerian and West African ecosystem. That's valuable. Embeddedness is the name of the game.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So I'll follow up with a question from our community. And I think this is particularly interesting because they're asking about what are the things that you discovered that were shocking for you as you're writing this book. And maybe I can bundle that with another question, which is, how would you summarize the key findings in this book to someone? Maybe 3-5 findings that you think they have to take away when they read the book, when they read this book.
Yeah. So I think the most surprising thing I discovered was how the venture capital and startup world in China, which today is the second biggest in the world, and is almost as big as America. I mean, it's done incredibly well, right? What's amazing is that it was built on the same playbook as the Silicon Valley ecosystem was built. Like, you would have thought, okay, China is really, really different to America. It'll be a totally different story as to how it grew up. No, it's not. It started because the same venture capital companies that have made it work in America came to China and brought the same lawyers who were doing it in Silicon Valley. And those lawyers came to China and they just repeated the thing. You know, they said, okay, stock options for employees. You know, we're going to do preferred stock for investors, common stock for the founders. You know, we're going to invest on a power law principle. We're going to really kind of be aggressive about reaching for contrarian, ambitious startups that really have a potential to make a huge outcome. When they go public, they're going to go public on the NASDAQ in New York. That was the original formula. It's changed today, but that was the original pattern. So what it taught me is that, you know, there are basic things about how venture capital can create a startup ecosystem, can create entrepreneurship. It's a machine for manufacturing courage, because being an entrepreneur is risky, as I was saying earlier. And so you need a venture capital partner who understands that it's risky and who can take some of the risk away for you by helping you as you go on your journey. So that's the single biggest surprise to me, that this was not just a Silicon Valley story, it's a global story.
Yes.
And I think that's also the biggest takeaway from the book.
Okay. So we are running out of time, but I'm just going to end with one question. And this one comes from Marilyn Sutro. So the question is about the fact that there is this article that was published in The New Yorker that says that venture capital is deforming capitalism by allowing well-funded companies instead of efficient companies to succeed. So I don't know what your take is on that, on whether venture capitalism is coming in and deforming capitalism, or is it a good force of nature?
Yeah, so of course I read that article, and in chapter 14 of my book, I explicitly write about it. And in the conclusion, I write about it again. And the reason I don't agree with The New Yorker is that the things that distort competition is kind of like these irresponsible later stage investors who invest like $500 million or $1 billion, right, in the Series G or something like that. So these tend to be like the Saudi Arabia Sovereign Wealth Fund, or maybe a big private equity fund, or sometimes it's a hedge fund that's doing crossover investments. And their idea is they come into Silicon Valley, they don't invest in this real startups, they invest in the established companies that are already unicorns, and they throw a lot of money at it and they say, we don't want a board seat, we're just gonna throw money at you. We're not gonna really pay attention to what you're doing. That can be a problem. That is distortive. That did explain why Uber went off the moral rails, right? So I agree with the New Yorker that that kind of investing is a problem. But that kind of investing is not really real venture investing. The real venture investors who invest at the beginning of a company, who do the seed, the series A, the series B, who partner with the entrepreneur, who go on the board, they're not distorting anything. They are a force for good.
Thank you so much, Sebastian. I've enjoyed every bit of this. And we can also see comments in the chat, people saying that this has been very, very good for them. So as we come to the close of the session, what I want to ask you is, where can people find your books and where can they also find you? Maybe that could also be a good, maybe if they're in London and they want to catch up with you, how can they find you?
Sure. So the book is available on all the ordinary websites that, you know, Amazon, if you like Amazon, or if you have another one, it should be available everywhere. It's published by Penguin, and Penguin is a worldwide publisher.
So if I can add one more place, it'll be available. We're currently distributing at the Collective, The Prosperity Paradox. So every new member of the Collective actually gets a book to welcome them into the Collective. And I wanted to tell you, Sebastian, that once we're done with our supplies of Prosperity Paradox, we're going to be giving every new member of the Collective your book. So that's another way you can get it.
That's 300 plus people, right? Around the world. Yeah. Okay,
no,
good.
No, we're super excited.
Thank you, Eve. So, great.
Maybe then, Sebastian, you can become a Collective member and we can give you a free copy also.
And then otherwise, you can find me on LinkedIn or you can email me. My email is very easy, S Malaby, like Sebastian Malaby, just my initial S Malaby, @gmail.com.
Thank you for listening to that Invest in the Future episode. Please follow us on social media. Our handle is @AnAfricanFuture on all platforms. You can join Future Africa to co-invest in these innovators who are turning Africa's biggest challenges into global business opportunities by joining the Future Africa Collective, our exclusive community of co-investors. Please find more information and apply at future.africa/collective. Thank you for listening once again.